Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. Listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we are joined by author Aaron Osman for a classic album dissection of John Prine's 1971 debut. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also hear feedback from listeners on recent episodes and bid farewell to Meatloaf. But first, let's jump into John Prine.
For Sound Opinions listeners, the name Aaron Osman should be familiar. She's the music writer who joined us last to talk about Jason Molina in October. Now we're very happy to have her back to help us dissect John Prine's debut album, which is the topic of her new 33 and a third book.
Listeners will also recall that we had John Prine himself on the show back in 2018, episode 651, if you want to look it up on any of our streaming platforms. Of course, there's nothing like talking directly to the artist, but Aaron's book paints a vivid portrait of Prine at the very beginning of his career by interviewing John's friends, family, and colleagues. Aaron, let's start by talking about what drew you to John Prine as a subject for a book.
You know, as Chicagoans, we hear the story, it's sort of this mythical thing, but also, you know, I ride really hard for the Midwest, and Prine is such an example of sort of low-key Midwest brilliance, right? So I think those two things together made me really want to sort of capture this moment in time and sort of convey his rise, which happened really quickly.
So for folks who don't know, tell the story of how this postman becomes one of the most respected singer-songwriters. You say at one point the Mark Twain of American songwriting, and I don't think you're wrong. I don't think that's hyperbole.
Yeah, I don't think it is either. It's really remarkable. You know, Prine, he started writing songs on an acoustic guitar to kind of play music with his older brother, right? So they could kind of hang out and have something to bond over. He took classes at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago to learn finger picking, right? To learn finger style guitar. And then it just so happened that he played an open gig at the Fifth Peg, which some of the teachers at the Old Town School owned at the time. So he sort of knew the folks that owned the club and thought, I'll give this a shot. And then eventually, you know, Roger Ebert's coming in to see him and writing about it in the Sun Times.
Sometimes it's nice, you know, if somebody comes up to me, you know, and they got a problem, you know, and I help them with it, you know, or they'll help me with my problems. But some people come up and they got all these problems, you know, and they tell them to you for about an hour, and then they walk away laughing. And you're stuck with their problems for the rest of the day.
And when that happens, all of Chicago took notice, right? Because Roger was such a respected writer at the time. And so it was kind of an example of the way that Chicago celebrates itself in this really unique and singular way that I haven't really witnessed anywhere else.
I don't talk much. I'm a quiet man. Beauty and silence both run deep. And I'm running like crazy while you are asleep. You got news for me. I got nothing for you. Don't pin your blues on me. Just go ahead and do whatever you wish to.
And then, after that, Prine's good friend Steve Goodman convinced Kris Kristofferson to come see Prine at the Chicago Club, right? Like purely mm-hmm. out of his appreciation and love for his friend's gift. And then Kristofferson was like, wow, this guy's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So really it was like friends helping friends, you know, elevate this guy who was kind of shy, kind of reluctant as a performer, but that the folks around him knew needed to be heard.
Yeah.
You know, you do a good job of building up the case for Prine prior to recording this record, what kind of a person he was, the family that he had around him, you know, the extended family that he was living with. Two of his grandparents were living with the family and all the siblings he had in the same house in Maywood, a very modest upbringing. I think the way you tell it, if John hadn't found music, there would have been a lot of issues. I think the line that was really telling for me was his older brother, Dave, in some ways, threw that lifeline out to John, his younger brother, who he saw, like, this guy's going to be, he's going to end up in jail. He's a lousy student, but he's got something. He's got this incredible imagination. That was a really telling anecdote that you developed in the book. And John always used to talk about his brothers with a great deal of fondness. In terms of developing that family side of the story, how did you do your research for that?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky. I was able to speak to two of Prine's brothers, to Billy and Dave, who are both still living, alive and kicking. Dave actually still lives in the mm-hmm. Chicago suburbs. So they were really helpful, really open with me, really enthusiastic about the project. So that was invaluable. They connected me with extended members of their family who live in Kentucky, right? So those family members sort of talked about the importance of that landscape to the Prine family writ large. From there, I was able to just sort of piece together this puzzle because I have a deep personal connection to the idea of Kentucky as it relates to the Midwest, because my family is in the same layout, right? Like my dad's family is all from Kentucky and I grew up making those sojourns. And I understand how that kind of old time Baptist religion makes its way into these Midwest corners and how that sort of idea really ties families together, right? It sort of acts like the glue, right? Whether you're invested in it or not. So I really saw a lot of myself in that. And I feel like hopefully, even though this is a journalistic work and I wanted to maintain that sort of journalistic remove, I hope also that sort of passion and familiarity and intimacy with those family units kind of comes through. And I think that's how I was able to do it.
Yeah, that song Paradise really talks a lot about, I mean, every song comes from some place, something that he experienced, and he was able to universalize it in a way. But that song Paradise really talks about those roots, right?
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that it's not a parable, right? It's taken straight from the headlines in the local papers. It's actually the true devastating account of how industrial mining destroyed his family's homeland.
And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
And I feel that, you know, I understand, you know, we underestimate these parts of the middle of the country and how these stories need to be told. I think that's why that's such a powerful song and why, like, even today, people will sort of replace paradise with their own tale, right, of having mm-hmm. reached by industrialization. And I think that's why it was so effective.
At the same time, Aaron, that you chart rural America, you bring the streets of Chicago in the era where Prine is coming up to life. And he was a postman and he was a city guy. You know, there's a great story about the album cover. It's John Prine sitting on a pile of hay. And from the beginning, you know, the record industry really didn't know what to do with this guy. And Prine told my friend and colleague Lloyd Sachs, you know, they could have had me on a bus or something. Would have been more true to John Prine's life. You know, he said he'd never sat on a bale of hay before, but he said they must have seen the inner hick in me. You know, Paradise, and the way you write about it, you did see the inner hick in John. What did you also see of Chicago through his eyes?
Yeah, I think just sort of like the everyday imagery that he conveys with such poetic clarity, right? Like he wasn't really ever trying to pull one over on the listener, right? Like there wasn't this sense of like a poet jester, like Dylan-esque thing kind of happening with Prine. I mean, he was just conveying the people and the scenes from his day-to-day life. And I think that's really important because those people and scenes aren't illuminated in song. They're not celebrated probably the way that they should be. And so yeah, I mean, I saw this guy walking around the city, walking around the suburbs, in the classrooms at OTS, just sort of recording in his head and then conveying that later. You know, it's a really simple existence that he was able to elevate in this poetic but accessible way that I think really appeals to any type of listener, right? That was kind of John's whole thing. And I think it's a very Chicago thing and a very Midwestern thing where he kind of wanted to invite everyone in, right? He didn't want to alienate anyone. He didn't think he was better than anyone, anything like that. He was a very welcoming presence, I think, in the way that he lived and the way that he worked. And to me, that is so Chicago.
Well, there's a lot of empathy, too. I mean, those songs, Donald and Lydia, you know, Sam Stone, Angel from Montgomery, every one of them is about somebody who feels left out, who doesn't feel like they belong to anything anymore. They're just out there on their own. And they're not the prettiest people. They're not the richest people. They're not the most connected people. They're just getting by day by day. Where did that empathy come from?
I think it's a couple of things. One, as you pointed out, John was raised at least for a while in a multi-generational household. He grew up with his paternal grandparents, went to church with them, spent a lot of time with them, right? And then also his extended kin in Kentucky. A lot of those folks were older, multi-generational, different walks of life. And so I think that's a part of it. I think the other thing is that I think John was just really interested in people. I think he just really liked people. That doesn't mean he was an outgoing guy or really wanted to center himself in social situations, but I think he really just liked to observe all the different kinds of people that he was growing up around. Because when we think about the Western suburbs, that was a truly integrated working class area, right? So he was growing up with Black people, with Latinx people, with older people, younger people, all these folks around him, I think was really fascinating to him, both on a human level, but also as a character study, right? I think from an early age, he was interested in reading like Steinbeck and he loved watching films. And so I think he was really adept at the study of humanity through the lens of a character. And he talks a lot about how like he was terrible in school, but he excelled at writing dialogue. You know, and so I think that's one of the few things that interested him, right? It was like imagining the thoughts and the lives of these everyday people around him.
There's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes. Jesus Christ died for nothing, I suppose. Little pitchers have big ears, don't stop to count the years. Sweet songs never last too long on broken radios.
It's a very Nelson Algren kind of approach.
Yeah, again, Chicago. Yeah.
Again, Chicago.
Yeah.
Tell us about the recording of this debut album, Aaron. I'd read a quote from one of the percussionists who played on the record, who said, when he first heard Prine, he thought it was going to be like trying to milk a dog to get this on record. I love that.
Yeah.
Which just indicates that he was the right guy to play with Prine.
Yeah. So, I mean, really, everything happened so quickly with this first album, right? The discovery, the deal. And Atlantic Records sent him to Memphis to work in American Sound Studio. And I suspect it's because they had just done Dusty in Memphis there. And that was a very successful album. And it was sort of placing someone who worked outside the confines of the South in the South with these incredible players, the Memphis Boys, right? They're like tantamount to the Wrecking Crew, right? They're like Memphis version of the Wrecking Crew. Looking to see how much we've grown, and the only one who could ever reach me, for the son of a preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me, for the son of a preacher man, yes he was, he was, oh yes he was. Prine was an experiment. It was their first folk singer-songwriter kind of signing on Atlantic. Atlantic was an R&B and soul label. And so they were like, okay, well, let's try this out. We hear a little bit of the country in this guy, so let's put him here. But the Memphis Boys had never really played on a folk record, right? They were really driven by the spirit of the groove and the intuitive playing of the groove around these big belter kind of singers. And so I think they weren't sure what they were going to do. The producer, Arif Mardrin, had never produced a folk album before. Mm. So I don't think he was quite sure what to do. And so the whole thing was just this wild experiment that I think turned out really well, given the circumstances, right? Like, Arif knew to bring in Leo LeBlanc, the pedal steel player, because he was like, well, that's a mark of country music. So, okay, let's fold that in. And then the Memphis Boys at a certain point just really took note of the lyrics. Like, I think they were right and just really observing and listening to the lyrics closely and knowing that that's what these songs were really about, right? And that's what they need to elevate. And so that's why we hear these little flourishes, like the funereal organ on Sam Stone and those kind of touches that I think was a product of their intuition, but also them making a pivot in service of this album.
Yeah. You kind of pinpoint that specific moment where they're midway through the session and one of the musicians said, let's listen to this record that we're recording. Let's go back and listen to what we've done. And it was the first time some of them had noticed those lyrics. And suddenly they had new respect for this guy that they're recording with. It wasn't just some kind of joke guy who can't sing from the Midwest that we've never heard of. And they had new respect for John Prine. It seems like that was a really telling moment when they knew that we had something special here on that moment, right?
Yeah, definitely. It was. I believe the guitarist Reggie Young. They had gone out to dinner after one of the days working in the studio. He was like, you know, guys, like, I really think you need to spend some time with these words, right? He was kind of like the champion of Prine among the group, and then they took note. Right. Obviously, they respected Reggie. And so I think from then on, yeah, there was a turning point, or they realized that like this was an important work. This was and it was a singular work, too. And it sort of remains that to this day. I've never heard a record like the self-titled record anywhere else. So, yeah, it was just sort of this magical thing that happened.
Let us know if you agree about John Prine's debut album being one of the great debut albums of all time. Is it a singular accomplishment? Let us know in our Facebook group or in our Patreon community, or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Coming up, we'll go deeper into the recording of the album, and later, we'll hear listener feedback. That's coming up on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. We're doing a classic album dissection of Postman Turned Troubadour, John Prine's 1971 debut. You know, in the more than 50 years since this record came out, it has dug itself deep into the lives of Prine's fans.
I've been watching the show American Rust, and Spanish Pipe Dream comes on.
Oh, nice.
And this isolated moment with Jeff Daniels.
Nice.
And he sings the line, "Eat a lot of peaches," out loud to himself. You know, it's kind of like, I'm going through this incredibly difficult time right now in my life, and I'm trying to deal with it, and who do I reach for? I could put on that John Prine record. You know, it's going to help me through this moment. That's what that record seems to have. You're right. I think it does stand outside of it. Even in the whole, he was coming up with the whole singer-songwriter scene, and he didn't sound like any of the other people out there. You know, he didn't look like them. He didn't sound like them. Totally unique. And then Arif Mardin to produce, I'm going, this, nothing about this was right. You know, it didn't fit in with anything. Here's this remarkable thing. What do you attribute that to? Because the industry is just a brutal, brutal place. How did that record manage to sort of gain this life beyond that era?
It was a slow build, you know, I mean, and Prime didn't, you know, up and move to New York or LA after the record came out. He stayed in Chicago and worked the clubs, right? Like I don't think he thought much of it at the time. I think he was just kind of like, well, I mean, this happened and that's great, but I'm going to keep working at the Earl of Old Town. You know, I think it was folks, obviously, like Bonnie Raitt covering some of the songs on Streetlights.
Make me an angel that flies from Montgomery. Make me a poster of an old rodeo. Just give me one thing that I can hold on to. To believe in this living is just a hard way to go.
It was a lot of peer recognition that I think resulted in this slow, gradual build. But, you know, over time, when we have folks like Dylan singing his praises, Bonnie Raitt, folks covering his songs like John Denver, right? Like all these kind of more known entities, right? America will take notice, because if America's heroes love this, then Americans should love this as well, right? And I think that's why it's so popular today, because we don't hear of a modern songwriter, right, who doesn't love John Prine. And I think that's why Prine and this album specifically will always be on the lips of music culture, because he is one of the greats. And, you know, so many people try to do what he did, try to write like he did, but no one really gets close. And so I think there's always this striving to the Prine brilliance that will happen, I think, in perpetuity, right? But yeah, it was just this perfect melding of like Memphis country music, Chicago folk music, friendship, belief in friendship, that just resulted in this really singular work. And by the way, all of those songs, not all of them, but most of the songs are, you know, accepted in the American Songbook as like standards today, which is remarkable too. It's basically a greatest hits album, which like, how often does that happen? Never.
That's
you
true.
Know?
As a debut. Well, it takes all those years walking around delivering mail, playing these songs in your head, as John told us when we were lucky enough to have him on the show. Let's talk about that writing. You know, Sam Stone, one of the songs that people always point to, I know about this troubled vet, you know, struggling with drug addiction. But Prine could have gone over the top and been more obvious in a Bruce Springsteen way. And he isn't. In fact, he never mentions the word Vietnam in that song. The guy is just back from the conflict.
Sam Stone came home to his wife and family after serving in the conflict overseas. And the time that he served had shattered all his nerves and left a little shrapnel in his knee. But the morphine.
I think that comes from Prine not wanting to alienate anyone. He was kind of like empathetic in that way, but I also think smart strategically, right? Because he didn't want anyone to feel left out of the conversation, but yet he wanted to write what he wanted to write. And so that song most definitely stems from his dissatisfaction with his time in the service, right? Like he served 2 years in the army in Germany doing nothing. And then his buddies came back from Vietnam and weren't cared for, right? Lost their minds, started using drugs. And so I think, you know, it's a composite of this sort of fruitlessness that he felt, or sense of futility around war and service, and then also what he observed in his friends and just kind of like the broader treatment of veterans. But you're right, like John's older brother Dave talks about how John was political at that time. Like they grew up in a family of like Roosevelt Democrats, right? Like they were very committed. But Prine was more subtle about it. And I think it's A, maybe he didn't want to draw a lot of attention to himself. But B, I think it's that feeling of like empathy and wanting everyone to feel like they can participate.
Well, and it lends a timelessness, doesn't it? Because Sam Stone, you know, absent the reference to the hole in the arm, right, where all daddy's money goes, could also be a returning veteran from Afghanistan or either Iraq conflict, you know, strung out on opioids. You know, it's that song is as timely today as it was when he wrote it in the 70s.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that like a 19, 20 year old guy would know that at the time. Right. But
yeah,
but maybe, maybe he was thinking strategically. Maybe he was thinking like, you know, I want this to apply to anyone at any time. I mean, who knows? But it has that effect, certainly.
Yeah. You know, the other thing I remember here in Angel from Montgomery, you know, I came to Brian. I was too young when that record came out to appreciate it or even know it existed. But I finally, you know, once you discover Dylan, then you discover other people that Dylan talks about, right? And Dylan used to talk about Prine a lot as a person he respected. That Angel from Montgomery, I heard that song. And I go, wait a minute, he's talking, he's the woman. He's the narrator is the woman. It's a man singing, but he's singing in this woman's voice. And I'm like, can you do that? Is that okay to do that in a song? It blew my mind.
When I was a young girl, well, I had me a cowboy. He weren't much to look at, just a free rambling man. But that was a long time, and no matter how I try, the years just flow by like a broken down.
It was so powerful in many ways. And how does that song resonate with you, Aaron? Because some people see it as a feminist anthem. Some people, I don't think anybody doesn't like the song. It's been covered countless times. But what it is about the song that speaks to you?
Yeah, I think you're right in everything you said, Greg. And I agree. You know, it was really remarkable, especially considering how young Prine was when he wrote that song. I mean, he was like 20 years old. So who even thinks to do that? But yeah, I mean, for me, I love the fact, and I think that this is kind of a signifier of Prine's implicit feminism, that he allows this woman to speak for herself, right? It's not him as a man narrating her from like a third party perspective, right? He's really crawling inside of her and sort of exploring her empathetically and conveying the depths of her dissatisfaction, in a really convincing way. And I think, you know, that's really important because, you know, he was exploring this realm that maybe many men weren't willing to explore at the time. But again, he's illuminating a sect of society that isn't often covered or celebrated, too. And I think that's important. So that combination of those things made it really stand out to me as one of the great songs in the American Songbook. Right.
Yeah, it absolutely is. It you know, a couple of thoughts, like, you know, what could have inspired him to do that? I think he must have had great parents. His mother must have been incredible. But also just, was there a precedent for that in a song that he may have heard that, you know, hey, that's something I could do? Because I think it's a pretty daring move. I mean, I just do. Do you have any sense of how that occurred?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes from a couple of things. One is, I think you're right, he had a great respect for the women in his family. His mom, you know, basically raised him, and he had a lot of respect for her. He had a lot of respect for his extended family in Kentucky, a lot of older and younger women who were basically running farms, you know, making their own clothes out of flour sacks and raising their own hogs and vegetables. And I think he saw a lot of strength and power in these female figures in his life. And I think the other thing is, you know, he was constantly just writing down ideas. And the story that I love about this song is that he actually workshopped it to the Holstein brothers, to Ed and Fred, who were local songwriters on the Chicago circuit at the time. And Ed had asked Prine, like, do you have any lyrics? Maybe we can come up with a co-write. He was like, well, I have this line, I am an old woman. And Ed was like,
he didn't hear it either.
Don't know where you're going there, John.
Yeah. He was like, do you have anything more like there's a hole in daddy's arm? You know, like,
yeah, man. Yeah.
But I think, you know, Prine probably took notice of that and was like, well, you know, I'm going to do something that maybe nobody else would do. right? Like, I think he saw that reaction and maybe fueled him to kind of make something unusual or make something less obvious, right? And it worked to really brilliant effect.
How the hell can a person go to work in the morning and come home in the evening and have nothing to say?
I was also startled to find, I just assumed that Illegal Smile was about pot, smoking pot. And your book kind of says, well, no, that's not really what he was writing about. He was happy to think that people thought that way about the song, but it didn't seem like that was the reason he wrote it.
It's hard to really know. But Prine, again, he was very smart and strategic in this way where he was like, well, you know, I don't want to alienate anyone. So, you know, I wrote it about me and my awkward tendency to laugh and smile in the worst situations, right? Like, that was his kind of line on the song. But for me, as a journalist and someone sort of interrogating this time in his life, it is impossible to believe that it couldn't have been about, you know, smoking weed. Because, you know, you guys know Old Town at the time was like the hub of head shops and hippies, right? It's all of Bohemia hung out. So he was around that culture. Even if he wasn't doing it, he observed other folks doing it and got a kick out of it. Right. Like, it may just be as simple as that, because, I mean, he was a funny guy. Brian was hilarious. And that's, I think, another mark of his songs, you know, amid all of this kind of heaviosity with Sam Stone and Angel from Montgomery. Like, he wanted to inject some lighter material, a little humor.
But fortunately, I have the key to escape reality. And you may see me tonight with an illegal smile. It don't cost very much, but it lasts a long while. Won't you please tell the man I didn't kill anyone? No, I'm just trying to have me some fun.
Well, Spanish Pipe Dream as well. You know, so he's around this this halcyon hippie heyday, but he's mighty skeptical of it. You know, the whole commune utopia, back to the land, hippies, free love thing. And that's what he's kind of taken on in Spanish Pipe Dream, no?
Yes. And his younger brother, Billy, had gotten really swept up in the hippie movement. He had the long hair, and Billy would tell his family, oh, I'm going to go move to California, live on a commune. And so I think Prine is satirizing his brother a little bit there.
Yeah.
Yeah, she give me a peck on the back of the neck. And these are the words she spoke. Blow up your TV. Throw away your paper. Go to the country. Build you a home. Plant a little garden. Eat a lot of peaches. Try and find Jesus on your own.
But Prine definitely embodied more of like the streetwise everyman. Like, when he was a kid growing up in Maywood, he embodied like the greaser look when everyone was growing their hair out long. I think he felt more connected to kind of like the pedestrian kind of a guy rather than
there
the
was counterculture. There was some punk rocker in John Prine. There absolutely was.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you talk about the whole folk scene developing in Chicago around that time. Prine coming along at a time when, you know, he probably would have been, what, second, third generation of this new iteration of folk. But John has always seemed to have marched ever since then. You know, he got signed to this big label deal. And Atlantic didn't do him any favors, I don't think, right? I mean, it wasn't like they knew what to do with this guy. I mean, they put him on a frickin' bale of hay on his own album cover. but here he is now revered. I don't think John ever veered from the guy he envisioned himself as in that first album. I mean, he's been that guy for, you know, the subsequent decades, right? I mean, it's pretty much that John Prine is the John Prine we know today, right?
Yeah, he wasn't interested in glamour and celebrity, I don't think, right? This didn't make it into the book, but I talked to just some regular Chicagoans who had encountered Prine in that time. And a couple of them told a story about how they saw Prine pick up his aunt in a limo in the western suburbs to drive her to his show. And I just love that. Like, I think that's like the extent of Prine's glamour, right? Like, I'm a Midwestern guy who's come into some money, and I'm going to pick my aunt up in a limo, right? And that's kind of what he did. He bought some Cadillacs, you know, because he was a car guy, and that was kind of it. And I love that. I love that authenticity, you know, and I think that's why folks in Nashville felt like they knew him, because they would see him shooting pool down the street. You know, that was just, he was content to live that life. He didn't need more than that. And I think that's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall, Greg, when we had him into the studio?
Yeah.
Spent a great afternoon with him. He wanted to go, Aaron, to an Italian restaurant. He didn't want to go to one of these fancy Italian. He wanted white tablecloth, red sauce, old school. So I sent him to Sabatino's up here on the northwest side, right, where the waiters were all 70 years old in tuxedos. And there was a 75-year-old woman playing the piano up. John thought it was the best meal of his life. I got an email from his wife, his manager, afterwards saying, oh, thank you. Thank you for sending us to Sabatino's, which is now gone, unfortunately. But... you know, I mean, that's John Prine. Give me a white tablecloth that I can spill red sauce on.
That's perfect for him, because he liked observing people in their natural environments, right? Like, he didn't like a lot of accoutrement or a lot of accessorizing, right? That's perfect for him.
You talk about Prine in the Chicago tradition. We've been talking a lot about that. Prine becomes a Chicago emblem, like Nelson Algren, Roger Ebert,
Studs Terkel,
Gwendolyn Brooks, Studs Terkel, Carl Sandburg. Wow. That's a huge compliment. I'm sure you thought about that one before you wrote that down. I mean, that was serious contemplation went into that one. What makes you think he? I'm not arguing with you, but I'm curious about your thought process in putting him in that pantheon.
Yeah, I mean, I think he just carries on that tradition of like this low key, sort of plain spoken brilliance, right? Like, when we think about these great Chicago writers, there wasn't a lot of sort of accessorizing. There wasn't this pretension, right? All of these people just sort of cut straight to our hearts and to our guts and to our souls. And I think Prine carries on that tradition in this very maybe obvious way, but maybe not so obvious, right? And I think when we think of all of these writers, they kind of have that common thread.
You know that old trees just grow stronger, and old rivers grow wilder every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in that.
So to me, and I argue this in the book, he is a part of that tradition, even if we don't think about him that way. And I hope it's a convincing argument, because I really believe it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe it too. I think it's great.
You got to keep writing books so we can keep having you on.
Thank you.
It's always fun to have Aaron Osman on Sound Opinions.
I really appreciate the two of you having me on and your support. It means a lot.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
That's it for our conversation with Aaron Osman. Coming up, we'll share some artist Prine influence and some of our favorite tracks. Then we'll hear some of your recent voicemails and say goodbye to Meatloaf. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
While digesting, Reader's Digest.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. We've been talking about John Prine's debut album today, but now we want to broaden it out to look at the effects he had on the music world beyond his debut album.
Greg, Prine was obviously hugely influential. There are no fewer than two great John Prine tribute albums, Broken Hearts and Dirty Windows, Songs of John Prine on Oh Boy Records. And wow, just look at the roster of people eager to cover his music. Bon Iver, Justin Townes Earle, Sturgill Simpson, The Drive-By Truckers, Amanda Shires, Brandi Carlile, Bonnie Raitt. It truly is impressive. Those all are more or less artists from the roots rock, alt, country end of things, whatever, however you want to trivialize it. But he spoke to people who were outsiders and who enjoyed humor, period. I raved about the Viagra Boys cover with Amy Taylor of Amel and the Sniffers of In Spite of Ourselves, right?
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow.
I mean, who would think that two of the snottiest punk bands would be loving John Prine in 2021?
Yeah, exactly, Jim. I think his influence continued to expand, especially in the latter half of his career. There was a period there in the 80s where a lot of people just sort of forgot about John Prine. And then slowly but surely got his own label together, started putting out records, started touring more regularly. I think in many ways, more people appreciated John Prine on the day of his death than maybe even back in the day when that debut album came out and blew everybody's mind.
And
I'm thinking about the artists he influenced. Iris DeMent has always been a big champion of Prine's music, and I remember meeting her in the early 90s, and she was just the sweetest, most down-to-earth, lady you could possibly meet. And Prine got her to do a bunch of randy, dirty duets on one of his albums in 1999, In Spite of Ourselves. They covered a bunch of country songs, and then Prine wrote one original for In Spite of Ourselves. So it was basically playing off that George Jones, Tammy Wynette dynamic, and he had Iris singing these duets with him about, couples, cheating on each other, and, just kind of these very, he said, I just love to hear the voice you would least expect to hear singing those kind of lyrics, sing those lyrics. Well, and he said Iris was the choice.
Angelic is an overused adjective, but truly fits Iris DeMint.
Well, Iris was, she grew up in a very heavily Pentecostal household. She was the 14th of 14 kids in that household, born in Arkansas, but ended up in L.A. with her family and, steeped in these Pentecostal hymns. But when she put out her debut album in 92, Infamous Angel, she was questioning all of that. And that's what I really loved about Iris, is that she was kind of had this questioning attitude towards spirituality and the existence of God, and at the same time a deep reverence for the music she grew up with, country, folk, bluegrass, a hint of those Pentecostal hymns. She brought it all together in that track, Let the Mystery Be, the first song in that first album that she put out.
Everybody is worrying about where they're gonna go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows where
And this whole idea of taking these existential questions, does God exist? What am I on this planet for? You know, these metaphysical kind of questions, putting it in plain spoken everyday language that anybody could understand. You know, it was just kind of like this whole idea, like you'd sit around talking with your mom at the kitchen table about something, you know, and putting it in a song. And that is a quality that John Prine always had. He would talk about these surreal, huge questions, but put them in these really down-to-earth terms that everybody could relate
this
to.
This is the Chicago literary tradition. Nelson Algren, Studs Terkel, Mike Royko, your former colleague.
Yeah. Surrealism mixed with spirituality. That, to me, was a lot of what John Prine was about. A lot of humor in it as well. Mm-hmm. So when you hear Iris Dement's Let the Mystery Be, I'm going, okay, this is kind of ties in with a lot of John Prine's themes that he was talking about, because he was trying to answer those same questions in his songs. And when I think of the quintessential John Prine song about God and spirituality, I think of Jesus, The Missing Years. You know, only John Prine would think about a song like, what happened to Jesus between the ages of 12 and 30? Yeah. I think I'll write a song about that, because nobody talks about those years in the Bible.
No.
The Missing Years. He's going to fill in the blanks for you. It is a hilarious song. And at the same time, it is also incredibly moving because he's talking, you know, he's bringing us up to, you know, why did Jesus die, right? Yeah. And, you know, it's not like he's preaching, but he's sort of, you know, kind of wrestling and ruminating about these issues in a very accessible way. And I think Iris Dement got that, and John Prine obviously embodied that throughout his career.
He discovered the Beatles. He recorded with the Stones. Once he even opened up a three-way package for old George Jones. Charlie bought the popcorn. Billy bought a car. Someone almost bought the farm, but they didn't go that far.
You're absolutely right, Greg, and I will underscore, you advise listeners to go back to the archive to episode 651 when we sat with John Prine in the spring of 2018. He was touring behind his last album, The Tree of Forgiveness. What's the Tree of Forgiveness? He tells us in a song on the album, I'm going to open up a nightclub called the Tree of Forgiveness and forgive everybody ever done me any harm. You know, and he was a character of the nightclub. You know, it's hard to picture John Prine as anything other than the guy at the end of the bar,
right,
telling great stories, fascinating the entire crowd at the bar. When I listen back to the song, When I Get to Heaven, which gave the Tree of Forgiveness its name, you know, what did John Prine want to do when he died? We didn't know at that time that he'd only be on this earth 2 years longer. He wanted to go to heaven. He wanted to be able to drink again, something he'd given up to save his life. He was going to order a vodka and a ginger ale. He was going to smoke a cigarette, something he had to give up in his life, that was 9 miles long, and he was going to form a rock and roll band. Ain't the afterlife grand, he said. That was everything he wanted. And, you know, those all sound like really good things to me.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I'm going to get a cocktail, vodka and ginger ale. Yeah, I'm going to smoke a cigarette that's 9 miles long. I'm going to kiss that pretty girl on the tilt of the world. Cause this old man is going to town.
What is your all-time favorite John Prine song? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show, like these messages from the past few weeks.
New messages.
Hey guys, Joe calling from Southern Oregon. I'm a baker here and we're listening to music all the time. Love your show. So appreciate what you guys do. Your little bit on the Throwing Muses was really cool to hear. I got into the Throwing Muses when they came out with The Real Ramona. It was this magical combination of incredible songwriting and brilliant execution. So beautiful. And I was sad when Tanya Donnelly left the band, but I've loved The Real Ramona as like my favorite Throwing Muses album ever since. Thanks so much for covering that great band. I love you guys.
Hey guys, Connor calling from Lawrence, Kansas. Love the show. Highly recommend a guy named Neil Francis out of Chicago. Great combination of funk, blues, and soul. His album In Plain Sight came out in early November. Give it a whirl. Thanks, guys.
Problems that you have aren't the ones on your mind, and you can't stop the rain. It's always
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Josh calling from Los Angeles, and I did not think I could love Amy Mann any more than I already do, but wow, that episode where you had her talk about five albums she really loves just made me love her all the more. She was just so insightful and so passionate about the albums that really helped shape her career. That's a great segment. I hope you keep doing it. I'd love to hear more of that from other of your interview guests. Thanks for doing that, and I'm looking forward to more.
You're out of reach. Now you're split in two, and each side still isn't you.
My album of the year would have to be Death of the Cheerleader by Pom Pom Squad. Produced by Sarah Tudson of Illuminati Honeys, the album has like this quiet, angsty confidence about it that I can't get enough of.
No more messages.
Greg, I do love hearing from our listeners.
I do too, Jim. And, nothing better than our listener calls, except for you talking about one of your favorite artists of all time.
We never censor each other. You, in a rare move, said, please don't use Meatloaf to diss Springsteen again. What I meant when I ever said that is, I think if you were going to make a perfect rock and roll teen angst sex mini opera from the perspective of the frustrated adolescent boy, as there had been so many great Spectre Wall of Sound girl group productions, you could do no better than Bat Out of Hell. Granted, it comes out in 77. I am an impressionable 13 years old. But I'm going to say something else controversial about Meatloaf to pay tribute to Marvin Lee Aday. Dead at the age of 74? Maybe. He said he lied all the time about his age. They think he was 74. I think I didn't see the difference between Bat Out of Hell and those first Ramones albums. Mm. They're coming out at the same time. Bat Out of Hell was a cartoon. It was intentionally a cartoon. Starts with the cartoon album cover. It's Broadway Schmaltz by Jim Steinman. But it's delivered with deep conviction by Meatloaf, who came not from the rock world, but the theater world. We all know he was Eddie in Rocky Horror Picture Show. He toured with National Lampoon's Touring Review. He did a lot of bad Broadway plays, right? So he brings a certain Broadway Schmaltz to these mini teen operas about being essentially what I was, a frustrated 13-year-old boy. I think it holds up in the sense of it being a cartoon. It is one of the best-selling albums of all time. Just like Meatloaf lied, the record industry lies. I've seen it claim that it sold 100 million albums. I think the more realistic, according to the BBC and NPR number today, is about 40 million copies of Bat Out of Hell sold. I think it is a perfect rock album, and I think Meatloaf never did anything else as good. The two sequels in 1993 and 2006 are just dreadful. The Broadway takes over. They're overproduced. Todd Rundgren intentionally overproduced Bat Out of Hell. He said the goal was to make everything louder than everything else.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But by the time you get to Bat Out of Hell 2 and then 3 in 2006, at which point Meatloaf actually brings his music to Broadway.
Right.
I got no use for it.
Well, and he still, those records still sold. And there was something about that record that connected with people in a way that I still can't quite put my finger on. But there's something
you were just a couple of years too old
about Meatloaf.
Yeah.
I saw him later on, on those sequel tours, right?
Yeah.
And the one thing that struck me about him was how sincere he was about what he was doing. He was playing a role, but he was throwing himself into it with such zeal that you couldn't help but enjoy it. Right?
Oh, yeah.
That's number one. Number two, underrated actor.
Yeah,
I will make a contention that Salt and Sea, one of my favorite movies of all time, Vince D'Onofrio and Val Kilmer.
He's great in Fight Club.
Crime noir.
Yeah.
But, there's there's a minor role for Meatloaf in that movie, and he plays a guy named Bo, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just going, wow, that's Meatloaf. He could act. That,
he could act.
He had a long string of film credits. So, and not to mention with Eddie and, you know, Rocky Horror. The guy had skills, and he was an incredibly entertaining interview. So
yes.
I give him lots of props for being just an all-around, you know, this is a larger-than-life personality who carried over to many aspects of his life.
Meatloaf, he's immortal in my book, Mr. Cod. What do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're all trapped in our apartments, our houses, because of the quarantine and COVID, and we're going to play a bunch of songs about getting away, going on vacation, finding some exotic island to camp out on whenever this is all over. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed, where this week we have the Mountain Goat's John Darnielle talking about his new novel, Devil House.
Good times, Greg. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo, and our intern, Mary Bernthal. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.